Hi, this is Alan Schartiger. I'm delighted to be in conversation today with Dr. Richard Holub. Dr. Holub is the president of Neurological Associates of Albany, New York, NAA, an organization that consists of clinical providing a full complement of neurological services and a well-established research center. The clinical arm of NAA currently has a panel of over 2,000 patients and provides comprehensive neurological services to over 1,000 patients diagnosed with Alzheimer's disease, MCI, or other forms of dementia. Dr. Holub is also the principal investigator for the research division of NAA, where he's been conducting phase 2 and phase 3 clinical trials for over 30 years. During his career, Dr. Holub has conducted over 125 successful clinical trials and has played a significant role in the investigation of all 5 drugs currently approved by the FDA for the treatment of Alzheimer's disease. He's also been involved in clinical trials investigation treatment for major depression, generalized anxiety disorder, multiple sclerosis, and painful diabetic neuropathy, among others. NAA's research division encompasses over 3,000 square feet of space and houses 3 experienced research coordinators, 2 psychometricians, a physician's assistant, as well as a lab and support personnel. The office has a fully functioning lab, a 2-chair infusion suite, 3 exam rooms, and 2 testing rooms. Since NAA staff pre-screens every patient, the division's screen failure rate is very low. NAA is noted for its ability to recruit high numbers of eligible patients and associated high retention rates. You can find out more at www.neurologicalassociatesofalbany.com. We'll talk to Dr. Richard Holub about all of this and more, but first, welcome Dr. Holub.
It's a pleasure to be here.
So let's start at the beginning. You've been on Medical Monday, and you've done a wonderful job for us, and I wanted you back here. We could just have a conversation going over the essentials. So what is Alzheimer's?
Well, Alzheimer's disease is a neurodegenerative disease that affects memory and thinking. And by thinking, we refer to other cognitive functions beyond that of memory, language functions, ability to recognize things, ability to use tools, appliances, et cetera, ability to plan and schedule, keep up with your checkbook, that sort of thing. These functions gradually weaken over time in Alzheimer's disease, and eventually they are lost.
Can it kill you?
Patients with Alzheimer's disease often die somewhat younger than their aged match general population control individuals. However, with Alzheimer's disease, as it progresses, the bodily organs in general begin to fail. It becomes easier to contract pneumonia, to contract a significant infection, and most of the patients become very weakened in general and will die from apparent other causes. But if they had not had Alzheimer's disease, they probably would have lived longer and healthier.
Okay, so now the question that everybody says, oh, I don't think my mother really had Alzheimer's. She had dementia, as if that's better. Is it?
Not likely. When Alois Alzheimer's identified this disease in 1906, 1907, it was considered a rare footnote article in the medical literature at that time. The woman herself who was affected was only 51 years old, and it was considered just a very unusual condition. It made it into a textbook shortly thereafter that included Dr. Alzheimer's name, which is why we use his name today. And then the condition fell into obscurity for most of the 20th century. In the 1970s, it was identified that there was, in patients with Alzheimer's disease, a deficiency of a particular brain transmitter called acetylcholine. And it raised the possibility that this condition could possibly have pharmacologic treatments. And about that time, another discovery was made, or just shortly after, that what we call senile dementia was really the same disease as Alzheimer's disease. And suddenly a disease which was considered rare suddenly became a disease which was prevalent. And we've changed the names over the years. Back in the 1950s, we used the term arteriosclerosis. And then a little bit later, we used the term chronic organic brain syndrome. And it was only really into the 1980s that the term Alzheimer's disease began to be spread and that there began to be an increased understanding that this was the most common cause of dementia. Dementia meaning any reduction in cognitive function for any reason. So you get hit in the head, you have a head injury, your cognition is decreased, it can cause dementia. You have a meningitis, you have a stroke, there's a reduction in your cognition, it's called dementia. But up and away, by far the most common cause of dementia is Alzheimer's disease.
What percent of Americans or of the world are going to end up with Alzheimer's disease?
Depends how long they live. You have to remember that in 1935, when Social Security was passed for age 65 benefits, the average American died at 58. So there weren't going to be many payments made. And we know in the mid-1960s, when Social Security was changed to permit people age 62 to get their benefits, the newspapers were loaded with advice to say, take your Social Security retirement at 62 because you're going to be dead at 65. That's in the mid-1960s. So it was really in the 1970s when we developed what some people call drugs that work. Led to an improvement in the general health of the population. We became more health conscious, and the average life expectancy started to grow and grow, and it became aware that with increasing age, the biggest risk for Alzheimer's disease is increasing age, and this has become an increasingly significant problem. It's such an enormous problem. Currently, 1 out of 5 Medicare dollars is spent on Alzheimer's disease. In another 10, 20 years, it's going to be 1 in 3 Medicare dollars. In another 10 or 20 years, it's going to exceed the federal defense budget. It not only involves the patient, but it also involves several family members. And so if the number of people affected are, say, 5.6 million now, and in 20 years, it's going to be 20 million because it's growing that fast. It meets the definition of an epidemic. And then you have those many family members involved. It's enough to affect the overall economy and the well-being of America as we know it today.
And if we get a PET scan of somebody with Alzheimer's, what are we going to see?
Well, right now, we did some work. Our particular group contributed quite significantly to the development of an Alzheimer's PET scan, which is not really currently available except through a special program that we have with Medicare, American College of Radiology, and the Alzheimer's Association. But that scan will show accumulated beta amyloid. Beta amyloid is a protein fragment. It's a naturally occurring protein fragment. It's useful when we're young. It belongs to a class of autoantibiotics. And so you get hit in the head, the brain gets showered with this beta amyloid and protects the brain from infection. And nature, as I said, really cares for us till we're about the age of 30 in the wild. We're healthy till 30 and we're dead at 35. However, after age 45, an age which nature never had a chance to correct, we begin to accumulate beta amyloid. And so with increasing age,
where does
we have
it come
more.
From?
It's made throughout the body, but in the brain, it's made intrinsically in the brain by the nerve cells, and we have a reduction in its clearance. So it's being made, but it's not being cleared, and it accumulates. And we can think of beta amyloid as the trigger of a gun. It's not the bullet, but if you don't pull the trigger, the gun doesn't fire. And the actual bullet is another protein that is called tau. And there's several forms of tau, but in Alzheimer's disease, well, in ordinary people over the age of 50, we collect some tau protein in the form of neurofibrillary tangles in the language and memory areas of the brain, and they sit there, and they're benign in that form. They hardly do anything. Most people don't notice anything. Some people say, I have a little word-finding difficulties. I'm over 50. Some people may have a little bit of reduction in recollection and recall, but it's really harmless. That little bit of tau doesn't do much. However, when the amyloid builds up to a certain point and hits that tau, the amyloid pulls the trigger and the tau is the bullet. You hold a bullet in your hand, it doesn't harm you at all. If you pull the trigger, it can be deadly. And the tau begins to spread and it causes the damage in the process of Alzheimer's.
So, Dr. Halab, how do we get rid of the beta amyloids?
Well, we actually got really good at getting rid of beta amyloid, but we haven't gotten very good at improving Alzheimer's disease. We first tried around the year 2000 with a vaccine, and the vaccine worked well, but it was very variable. So we might give the vaccine to somebody so that the body would generate antibodies against the beta amyloid, get rid of the beta amyloid, which it did. In some people, it did a very weak job. In a number of people, it was such an overwhelming response that they actually developed brain hemorrhages and were very sick and hospitalized, and it was serious. So it was decided, well, why don't we, instead of letting the patient make the antibodies with the vaccine, why don't we just make those antibodies in the lab and then infuse them in patients so we can give them the proper dose so we don't get this variable response that we get with the vaccine. So we did that, and I've spent years doing that in several iterations, and we've gotten really good at getting rid of the amyloid, but we haven't found the exact, I'll call it, sweet spot of what age and what level of condition do we apply that. And so at every point when we've done this, we've kind of found that we've gotten rid of the amyloid, but the disease still progresses. We've come close recently with a drug called solanezumab, where we're taking people with slightly affected very early Alzheimer's disease. And their trial was, a recent trial was negative, but it was negative right on the borderline of being positive. It was really close. We do have trials now in the United States and a big one in Colombia, South America, where we're providing this drug and another one, the solanezumab, and another drug we're using in our office called crenezumab, to give to family members who have genetic Alzheimer's disease. If they have the gene, they know they're going to get it. That's a rare condition, but there's a large population in Colombia, South America. And we're trying to provide them with this treatment before they develop Alzheimer's disease to see if we can forestall or prevent the onset. So we're trying to find how early can we give an anti-amyloid antibody, get rid of the amyloid, and prevent the onset of the disease. And we quite haven't found that spot. I think we will. I think other treatments, however, will become more widely used and developed.
I love talking to Dr. Richard Halab, a neurologist, talking about Alzheimer's. I'm incredibly impressed with the breadth of your knowledge. You said a couple of things that need to be developed a little bit, I think. And one of them is show symptoms of early Alzheimer's. What are those symptoms? Everybody out there is saying, tell us, do I have it?
Well, Alzheimer's disease, number one, patients will have a change in their memory and cognition. As I said, all of us after the age of 50 will have a few memory glitches, a few word-finding glitches, and they may trouble us, and we may think, oh, my Lord, I'm getting Alzheimer's disease. But often it stays at that low-grade level and is not an issue. When we start misplacing items occasionally, might not be an issue. When we start misplacing items all the time, when your grandchild goes to the kitchen and picks up your keys and gives them to you because you have forgotten it the last five times and your grandchild in grammar school knows you're going to forget them, it's time to see the doctor. There's a tendency towards repetitive questions. We can all ask a question, forget the answer, ask again. But when repetitive questions get more and more and more, we know there's a decrement to recent memory. That's an important clue. We've always taken care of our checkbook and our schedule, and we find that our spouse or our adult children just seem to need to start helping us. That's usually an indication that we're moving away from what I would call normal aging into the area of Alzheimer's disease. When we start having increasing difficulties with our sense of direction, and it's very insidious. I've always driven from my house to the Northway Mall, somebody might say, but now I have to sit in the car for a few minutes and think about the route that I'm going to take. It's no longer automatic. They're having trouble with their geographic maps as they're laid out in the brain, and it's a sign that they're beginning to get issues, even if it's early. Another thing is recognizing things. Occasionally, all of us will have trouble recognizing something. Most of my male patients will call that refrigerator blindness. You know, their wife sends them to the refrigerator to get the milk. They open the refrigerator. It's right in the front. They can't see it. And their wife goes and just grabs the milk and says, can't you see it? And you didn't see it. Occasionally, that's fine. But when not being able to recognize things right in front of you becomes more and more of an issue, there's a crowded tabletop desk or something, and you're going to grab the the scissors or the stapler, and you just can't find it, and that's getting worse and worse. That's an issue. So those are some of the things that when they reach a point that they begin to interfere with your function, other people notice them, you better get evaluated.
Okay, you get evaluated, and then what?
Well, you will see a physician, maybe a neurologist who's interested in memory disorders, cognitive neurology, Alzheimer's disease, and you'll likely get a scan of the brain, an MR scan of the brain, basically looking for other things, looking to see if there's subclinical stroke injury that may be contributing to this cognitive issue, seeing if there's a benign, usually benign, occasionally malignant brain tumor that's sitting there that's affecting memory and cognition, or some other condition other than Alzheimer's disease that might explain it. Sometimes a simple MRI might actually reveal some thinning of the gray matter in a pattern that will actually tell the radiologist and the neurologist that this really is quite consistent with Alzheimer's disease. Mm-hmm. That's not real common. Most usually the MRI is to exclude other things. They may have other assessments along the vascular disease line, such as getting a carotid ultrasound, and they'll get some memory disorder blood work, and it'll look for deficiencies that are contributing to cognitive impairment. Some people who eat well, do everything right, may not absorb B12 very well. So they eat it, but it passes through their system, and their B12 levels are low, and it can affect their memory or cognition. There can be very commonly issues with low thyroid, which can affect memory and cognition. Some people have Lyme disease and don't know it. So there are a number of metabolic conditions that the blood work can pick up and identify that they're either contributing to or maybe representing the primary cause of the cognitive issue. So that's the workup. And then if the pattern and character of the things that we discussed fall into a picture that suggests Alzheimer's disease, then a physician might consider initiating a medication.
But from what I heard you say, and this is what has me inquiring about this, we don't really have a good medication yet, do we?
No. What we certainly don't have is a cure. Mm-hmm. We do not have a cure for this disease. What we have are what I call the platform medications that we use are called cholinesterase inhibitors. One is called Aricept, generically donepezil. Another is called Exelon, generically rivastigmine. Another is called Remenil, generically galantamine. We had another one we no longer use called Cognex, also called Tacrin. And these drugs increase the concentration and availability to the brain of the deficient neurotransmitter called acetylcholine, which is diminished in Alzheimer's disease. And so it's a medication that helps people to function a little better, a little longer. They seem to have a slower decline that may be real, or there may be other factors making it appear to be a slower decline. So these medications have a usefulness and a benefit. I have to say that I work with Alzheimer's patients for a couple decades before these drugs were available, and I've worked with them since, and there seems to be a slowing of decline. Other things that aren't related to Alzheimer's disease may be contributing to that slowing of decline in terms of controlling blood pressure and controlling blood sugar and other things that affect medical health. But in general, these drugs are not considered to be disease-modifying, and those who believe they're disease-modifying, they're not strongly disease-modifying, but they do make a difference. So they are weak, they are helpful, they do make a difference, they are not a cure.
You mentioned blood sugar. Let's talk about diabetes and Alzheimer's.
Well, patients with diabetes, which is well controlled, don't have any greater risk of Alzheimer's disease than a general population. There's a measurement for diabetes called the hemoglobin A1C, which reflects the average blood sugar over a three-month interval. And normally a number ranges, let's say, we'll pick a number, say around six. You can let that number rise to a number of about seven, and your risk of Alzheimer's disease is still about the same as the general population. But as the hemoglobin A1C rises above seven, the risk of Alzheimer's disease grows and grows and grows. And in the people who aren't making any attempt to control their diabetes or can't control it, and their hemoglobin A1C is in the range of 13.5 or something, their risk of Alzheimer's disease is 85%, which is essentially 100%. Those people are absolutely going to get Alzheimer's disease.
exercise?
Exercise is the most important mitigating factor against the development of Alzheimer's disease or the slowing of that disease. Why? When we exercise, we automatically begin to generate neuroprotective factors. In animal studies where they have these animals running on these wheels, et cetera, and they don't let other animals run on these wheels, and then they measure their spinal fluid, within 20 minutes of exercise, they are producing increasing neurotrophic factors for the brain. Why that is, I don't think we entirely know, but we know that it is. And of all the kinds of things we can do, and there are many, exercise is the most important. Almost every trial we do looking at exercise and mitigation of memory loss, mitigation of Alzheimer's disease, exercise is almost always a positive experience. And it doesn't have to be aerobic exercise, although that might be better. It can be housework, yard cleaning, that sort of thing.
Smoking.
Smoking is was kind of on the fence for a long time. Smoking is now felt to be a risk factor for dementia and Alzheimer's disease. There have been studies on patients who were former smokers and then quit. As long as 25 years ago, they quit. And now they're studied today with MR imaging in a research fashion. And people who are still smoking versus people who never smoked. And what you see is in the people who never smoked, for their age, they have a proper thickness to the gray matter cortex, which reflects the normative average for non-smokers. In people who are current smokers, there is clear thinning of the gray matter cortex. And for people who quit years ago, there is some recovery of this. The literature uses the term recovery. I don't think they actually have enough studies, but they have sort of an in-between the normal and those people who are still smoking. But even some people who have quit as long as 25 years ago will have some gray matter, matter thinning of the cortex. So smoking is definitely not good for gray matter functioning.
Coffee.
Coffee has a great deal of beneficial ingredients, antioxidants. It's just loaded with antioxidants. It's off the chart with antioxidants. I don't know why. This Ethiopian bean that's now spread throughout the world has a great deal. Tea has quite a number of antioxidants, but not as much as coffee. So a few cups of coffee is helpful in terms of providing antioxidant benefit, which reduces the damage that is imposed by certain metabolic processes that cause these free radicals that antioxidants neutralize.
And there is a relationship between the free radicals and the Alzheimer's?
There is a presumed relationship. The science isn't tight. Free radical injury is a problem. It's accelerated by certain medications, improved by others. These are byproducts of metabolism where highly charged, dangerous, intermediary metabolism molecules are formed, and they can cause cell damage. We have our own systems for mitigating this, but sometimes those systems can get overwhelmed, and the free radical injury can contribute to Alzheimer's disease and other neurodegenerative processes. And indeed, one of the medications we have available to us, it's a weaker medication called Namenda or memantine. Its primary goal is to reduce overexcitation of the brain, which can lead to injury. How effective that medication is isn't clear. It did get FDA approved. We do use it for people with more severe memory loss, but it shows you that scientists in general are concerned about factors of overexcitation as well as free radicals.
I want to get into that term, which I have never heard before, of overexcitation. What does it mean?
We have certain pathways in the brain that excite the brain. One of them is the NMDA system, and that particular system might get overly turned on in certain disease states, occasionally with stroke, occasionally with epilepsy, and pour out excitatory neurotransmitters, which can overactivate the brain and to a point that you begin to have brain injury. You know, you can exercise at a certain level every day,
sure,
and push yourself just a little bit and you're okay. But if you go way beyond your limit, suddenly you're tearing your muscles down and you're causing injury. And that's the same analogous model.
Dr. Halab, you mentioned vitamin B12. Now, if I heard you correctly, because I take it every night, I heard you that some people who develop Alzheimer's don't have the capacity to absorb that B12. Is that right?
Yes, and a little bit no. Vitamin B12 deficiency without Alzheimer's disease can include memory impairment and cognitive loss. Vitamin B12 is necessary for cognition. It's also necessary for the spinal cord to function well. So it, when it's impaired, it can affect gait, balance, and coordination. There are two different defined pathways that a deficiency leads to problems, and one involves the spinal cord, the other involves memory and cognition. So if you have Alzheimer's disease and B12 deficiency, you have double trouble. People can have B12 deficiency and develop cognitive impairment and not Alzheimer's, and people with Alzheimer's don't have to be B12 deficient. But B12 deficiency is not uncommon. And the way this comes about in people who eat well and do everything, if you don't eat well, then you can get deficient that way. But most people who get deficient, they're eating well, but their body develops an autoantibody against the lining of the stomach that permits the absorption of vitamin B12. The stomach produces a molecule called intrinsic factor, which attaches to B12, and then further down in the small intestine, that B12 intrinsic factor combined molecule is absorbed. But if the lining of the stomach is inflamed by an autoantibody, then that absorption does not occur and the B12 passes right through the system. While this is more common in people of Northern European extraction, I think in my practice it's most common in people who are from Ireland, but anywhere in Northern Europe it's more common. It can occur in anybody, and I've had one young African-American woman who had B12 deficiency, so anyone could potentially get it. And so that deficiency, if it's unidentified, contributes to cognitive impairment.
How much should I take? I mean, I take 1,000 now. Should I take 5,000? Should I take 10,000?
I think it would be helpful if, when you got your routine blood work with your doctor, if they checked your vitamin B12 level. It's likely at 1,000 international units a day. Oh, actually, it's called micrograms a day. That it's likely that your vitamin B12 level is through the roof. If it's not, then your doctor may say, "Hey, you know, why don't you up it?" But I suspect that the 1,000 micrograms a day is plenty.
Right, because we don't know. We go to drugstores and we see B12 for 1,000, we see 5,000, we don't know what to do. And I think that you're quite right. You go to the GP and you say, "Test me out."
Yeah, we know that vitamin B12 and B1, which is thiamine, and vitamin C, they're water-soluble vitamins. They're less likely to cause toxicity if you take too much. The fat-soluble vitamins like D and A and E are stored, particularly in the liver, and there is a potential for you to take too much and cause liver injury. And so it's uncommon, but it's important that your doctor know that you're taking these supplements, and some of those, particularly vitamin D and B12, can easily be checked with common blood work.
Has D been tied to Alzheimer's?
D hasn't been directly tied to Alzheimer's disease. And for the longest time, maybe 100 years, we knew that vitamin D was important for bone metabolism. So vitamin D and calcium became common supplements for strong bones. It's called the sunshine vitamin because if we expose ourselves to the sun, our body can manufacture vitamin D. But if we're not so exposed to the sun, then the levels can be quite low. And indeed, I think 90% of the Capital District is vitamin D deficient. I'm not sure why, but just from extrapolating my patients in my practice, I'd say a huge number of people are deficient. It was probably about 10 years ago or so that it was identified that all the cells in the body, not just in the bones, all the cells in the body had vitamin D receptors. And they said, uh-oh, if the receptors are there, maybe the vitamin D is doing something to all the cells in the body. And we are in the process of trying to unravel that. We did find that vitamin D deficiency contributes to inflammations in the body. So it may aggravate inflammations like multiple sclerosis, like various of the arthritides, like, say, inflammatory bowel disease, like thyroiditis. So the inflammations, the auto-inflammations that we get can be aggravated by a deficiency and benefited by a therapeutic blood level. But again, if you're taking vitamin D supplement, ask your physician if he can let him or her know, and then ask them if they can check the level. I haven't actually had a patient who's toxic in vitamin D, but I do check them.
You have to take a lot of it to get toxic, I think.
Yes.
Dr. Richard Halab is with us, and as you all know and have recognized by listening to him, he's quite an expert on Alzheimer's disease. I guess I want to ask you about proton pump inhibitors. You mentioned that the stomach can be sensitive with some of these drugs, but many of us have taken this to stop acid reflux, and I'm wondering whether there's anything on that.
There is not. Certainly anything that affects gastric absorption or gastric function needs to be looked at and needs to be studied. And there are enough people taking proton pump inhibitors to decrease stomach acid, to benefit reflux, to benefit hiatal hernias, that we can epidemiologically begin to explore. We don't have any tight relationships with Alzheimer's disease at this time. There is a rare person who can develop chronic renal failure from proton pump inhibitors. Who would have thought it? So we're beginning to see some unusual relationships to the use of these drugs, but we're really very early in that. There are two kinds of side effects you get with medications. You know, the first is a direct toxic effect, which a particular drug used for a particular purpose gives you a benefit, but there may be some collateral injury which maybe you can put up with or maybe you can't. A drug may make you to be nauseous, but benefit something else, you might put up with a little bit of nausea. And those would be called acute side effects. But then you have long-term side effects, and they only become discovered over years and years, often inadvertently.
Not in the FDA tests. You get, a few thousand people, and then you give it to millions of people, and all of a sudden we figure out what this is all about.
Exactly.
Okay, so I want to talk to you a little bit about genealogy, obviously. I think people who are listening to this show on Alzheimer's with you, Dr. Richard Halab, are concerned with that because my uncle has it, my brother has it, my mother has it. This ain't good news, is it?
No. Again, we're living longer, so we can, just by simply living longer, we can increase our risk of Alzheimer's disease. In general, the party line would be that a small number of people have genetic Alzheimer's disease. A very small number. And these people might get the disease in their 20s, 30s, 40s, early 50s. And this is where 50% of the offspring of a parent who's got this gene will have the gene and they will get Alzheimer's disease. It is guaranteed. Usually a very early onset, and nothing will prevent it or stop it. All of the genes that are abnormal that lead to genetic Alzheimer's disease result in an overproduction of beta amyloid, which is the trigger that initiates this process. We know that in patients with Down's syndrome, where they have three chromosomes, chromosome number 21 is the one where the beta amyloid is encoded, and so they, instead of getting just one dose from mom and one dose from dad, they have three doses without any genetic predisposition. They have three versus two doses of amyloid, and they begin to get Alzheimer's disease in their 30s, 40s, and 50s. So anything that genetically promotes increased amyloid, but that's a small percentage of the population. There's a larger percentage of the population, I'll call it the middle percentage, that will have a risk factor. The biggest one is called apolipoprotein E4, or ApoE4. And this is a protein, a lipoprotein. It carries fats and cholesterol in the blood, but it's also in the brain, and it's likely involved in some way with the transport and clearance of amyloid in the brain. It's also felt to be related to repair factors in the brain. And those folks who have ApoE4 have an increased risk of Alzheimer's disease, and that risk makes it that they are likely to get it 10 years earlier than the general population. If you were unlucky enough to get two APOE4s, one from mom and one from dad, then you would likely get Alzheimer's disease 20 years earlier. There are some people, however, who have one or two APOE4s and don't get Alzheimer's disease. And this is the most prevalent of the risk factors, this APOE4, and therefore we call it a risk factor. If you have a genetic factor, you have the gene, you're going to get the disease, it's guaranteed. If you have a risk factor, you've increased your risk, you're really in danger of getting the disease, but you may not get it. And the things that mitigate it are, you know, exercise, but also keeping your left language brain busy with reading. If you read, talk about it. If you see a movie, talk about it. If you do word puzzles or Sudoku, any of those things are helpful to keep that left language brain activated.
How about retirement? Here I am, I'm 75 years old. People say, when are you going to retire? And I always say, when they carry me out. But I think that speaks to your language issue, doesn't it?
It does, and not just language issues. You know, there are also nonverbal areas in the right brain that have to do with abstract thinking, with art and music and hobbies and crafts, which aren't necessarily tied to language, that are right brain strong. And you know, if there's something you like to do, I mean, there's been a book written about the benefits of crocheting for Alzheimer's prevention. You know, there's some evidence that it's a right brain craft or hobby that is beneficial. And so the exercise, left language brain, the right brain for arts, crafts, music, hobbies, that sort of thing. Socialization is very big. We're social creatures. We live in social groups, and it's very important for socialization, even if we're not socially inclined. You know, we should handcuff ourselves and go to that meeting or go to that show or go to that party and be out there meeting and greeting. And all those things, from the exercise and the left brain, language activities and the right brain, art, crafts, music, and the socialization, all of those things likely increase the neuroprotective factors in the brain.
Playing the banjo, is that helpful?
Absolutely.
So I should do it more.
You should do it as much as it encourages you to continue with it. You know, we can always overdo things. But yeah, people should get out there and do as much as they can do. And then, of course, you know, don't discount diet. We've touched on diet
a little bit.
Low-fat, low cholesterol, cardiac friendly, preferably Mediterranean. We use this jingle in cognitive neurology called what's good for the heart is good for the brain. We know that a heart healthy diet is important for brain health, likely for similar reasons. We don't have it worked out. We don't have the complete answer. I believe that we know that large vessel arterial disease, whether it affects the brain with stroke, the heart with heart attack, or the extremities with peripheral vascular disease, involve arteries, disease of the arteries. There's a thinking that in Alzheimer's disease, it's known that there's dysfunction of the capillary beds, the small beds. So it's not the large arteries, but it's the microcirculation. And so the mitigating vascular risk factors likely is benefiting the microcirculation in Alzheimer patients, and that's likely why it's beneficial. There's a lot of evidence to suggest that it's not certified yet.
Are we better off with a vegetarian diet than a meat-eating diet?
Haven't gone there, Alan. I think that there are problems if we overdo, particularly red meats. I think there are problems. I think they've been pretty well established. But if we eat some meat, maybe tilting away from the red meats and keeping our cholesterol low and our HDL high and other cardiac risk factors in line, I think we can eat some meat. And we do get problems if we're entirely devoid of meat, if we are. There have been some medical issues that people who are vegetarians are trying to responsibly avoid by juggling their diet.
We're going to find a cure to this thing?
I believe we're going to find a cure to Alzheimer's disease. And I believe we're not as much in the dark as we think. There is this growing wave of subtle, I'll call it optimism, rising in the neuroscience community. I go to national meetings twice a year at least, and at our international meeting this past July, another one coming up this coming July, there was this rising sense, and I've said it before, quoting, you know, Churchill, we're really feeling that we're getting towards the end of the beginning, that we really have our foot in the door. We really think we understand the relationships of the processes that cause this problem. We're missing the fine details. We know that things are connected, but exactly the number of micro steps that lead from A to B are not fully understood. And we understand these processes enough that we can target potential medications to mitigate the problems. And there are a number of potential areas where we might really stop this disease in its track, and we're in hot pursuit of those.
Talk to me, Dr. Halab, about Alzheimer care. You're a neurologist, of course. You treat the symptoms, you treat the disease. But clearly, people who have Alzheimer's patients in their families are going to want to know about the best thing to do. You put the person in a nursing home, a memory care unit, or do you find somebody to live with them? And a lot of that comes down to money, of course, but what's your advice?
It's very individual, related to the patient who has Alzheimer's disease, related to their living circumstance, related to the family and their availability. And I have some patients who have adult children, but they're all out of state, highly involved, doing what they're doing. In those particular patients, there are very good residences, assisted living residents, some of which are directed towards memory care, that really are enlightened and provide very good care and can become a home. When people have more advanced disease, nursing homes are a necessary next step if you're not at home. And nursing homes have more responsibilities. They're providing a wider level of care. It's difficult for them to provide as rich an environment as they would like for patients with memory impairments, but they are actually trying. I thought maybe 20 years ago that nursing homes were simply a death sentence. I don't think that anymore. I think there is a certain enlightenment and some clear progressive plans to enrich the nursing home experience. However, if somebody's well situated in their home, I have a number of patients who have adult children who are living in an apartment upstairs, or they're living next door or down the block, who might have some time on a regular basis and can check in. Certainly with people with early Alzheimer's disease, you can gauge safety very easily. And if you have one or two signs where things are becoming unsafe, then maybe you need somebody living in-house at that point. And if you can find the right person, if it's a family member, great. If it's not, you find somebody, that would be helpful. But every situation is highly individualistic, but we've seen every pattern, and it usually relates to the nature of the patient, the nature of their living circumstance, the nature of the family, and the monetary availability.
What would you do? What would you want?
What would I want? So if it was a family member of mine...
No, if it was you.
If it was me. Okay, getting more personal. If it were me, I would prefer to be in my own home as long as it was safe and responsible. I think that there's a certain stabilizing experience to being in your own home. The picture is on the wall where it always was. The door and the window are always where they were. What's on the counter is always there. And those orienting objects in your home environment are very stabilizing. But when safety becomes an issue, if you can't have someone initially part-time and then full-time at home with you, then it's time for assisted living. You know, if patients are at home and they're going to travel to a wedding for their Aunt Tilly or something, then it's not a bad idea to take things off your countertop or a picture off the wall. And when you're in that hotel room, to put the picture on the wall and put things on the countertop to help stabilize and orient the person.
Wow.
Yeah.
Do Alzheimer's patients commit suicide in larger numbers than other people without the disease?
I don't know the exact statistics. It is exceedingly low, probably because as the disease advances, they're not as capable of putting together a plan. Depression is really common, particularly early on.
Right.
It's almost part and parcel of the condition, but it can be treated. And as time goes on, depression is usually not an issue.
Sleep.
Yeah, sleep is really important. And
then I'm a dead man.
So sleep is important because during sleep, during slow wave sleep, when we are not dreaming, slow wave sleep, phase 3-4 sleep, memories stored during the day in the short-term sides of the brain called the hippocampus migrate to the frontal lobe for long-term storage. And if sleep is disrupted, then the phase 3-4 sleep is condensed. We don't get as much transference of information for long-term storage, and it can be an issue. There are some people who get very little sleep, and their brains become very efficient at transferring that information in the little time that they have to do it. But as we get older, we don't sleep as well, and we toss and turn, and we're up and we're down. Our bladder is getting weaker. There are other issues. And so this definitely is a problem, and it can aggravate Alzheimer's disease for sure. And we actually do, one of our research programs right now is directed towards trying to promote better sleep architecture, better sleep structure.
How?
As we know, there are certain naturally occurring compounds like melatonin that help us to define our 24-hour cycle. You know, what is day, what is night, when we should be awake, when we should be asleep. Without other interferences, if we're put in a box that is, I'll call it a biosphere, no windows, no clocks, we don't know what it is. After a day or two, we're up for 16 hours and we're sleeping for 8.
So that's all positive.
Yeah. But we have all these other influences on us. And so the naturally occurring melatonin helps promote that. And we're working with a medication that's a derivative of that. I'll call it their hopes that the drug is a melatonin on steroids. You know,
melatonin over the counter is not what you're talking about here.
It's not what I'm talking about. No, I'm talking about a pharmacologic product. But melatonin is used. It's used by highly regarded neuroscientists in doses that may be initially 3 milligrams. Then, if there's not a good response over a month or so, then 6 milligrams. And if there's not a good response over a month or so, then 9 milligrams. And currently, the literature stops about 9 milligrams. There aren't any major side effects at that point, but giving it time, it doesn't put you to sleep when you take the pill, but over a period of weeks, it helps to encourage you to sleep when you should and be awake otherwise. So we do, at our office, try to have research programs that are directed towards various potential therapeutic targets in Alzheimer's disease. And so we do have an anti-amyloid infusion program. We do have a program that's directed towards sleep. We do have programs that are directed towards improving the acetylcholine function by mechanisms that are different than the currently available drugs. So there are multiple therapeutic targets, and we try to have a splay of programs so that whoever comes in the office, there's a possibility that there might be a program that might be a good fit for them.
So you're a very good neurologist, obviously, and you know a great deal. You know, somebody comes in, there used to be an old saying about neurologists, long gone, diagnose and adios, and that has changed because a lot of procedures that neurologists can do now. There used to be huge fights between the neurologists and the neurosurgeons. But you're making progress. But why do you do it? I mean, look, are you just interested in patients, or is the reward from creating a new drug that great that your family would never have to work another day in their lives?
Those kind of rewards will go to people other than us neurologists.
Mm-hmm. But you do a lot of studies.
Yeah. We do the research. You know, I personally got interested, and I have mentioned this before. When I was a preschooler, my grandfather watched me during the mornings, and he had Alzheimer's disease, or what I now recognize was Alzheimer's disease. He was forgetful, and then I saw him as I got a little older, gradually deteriorate and succumb to that illness, and that left a big mark on me personally. And then later, late high school, early college, I worked as a nurse's aide, and I was assigned to a memory disorders unit. And I worked with patients. At that time, they were using the term COBS, chronic organic brain syndrome, not Alzheimer's disease, but it was the same condition. And I became very involved. And it probably contributed my decision to go into neurology. I feel this is a huge problem for society, and it's a problem that affects almost everybody. Almost everybody knows somebody with Alzheimer's disease. This is a pervasive problem, and to have the opportunity to be involved in working with a condition that involves almost everybody and to be in a position where you might find yourself one small cog in a huge machine that might eventually bring us to the point of having a cure for this disease is very exciting.
We've been in conversation today with Dr. Richard Halab, the president of Neurological Associates of Albany, PC. Dr. Halab, I can't tell you what your being here means to all of us. I have such great respect for what you do and for what you know, and I want you to come back and keep coming back to talk to us. I appreciate it so much.
Well, thank you very much for inviting me. I enjoyed it.
Listening to Dr. Alan Chartok, President and CEO of WAMC Northeast Public Radio and Professor Emeritus at the University at Albany. For more information on WAMC's In Conversation with Alan series or to order a physical copy, call 1-800-323-9262 or subscribe to our podcast on iTunes, Stitcher, or on the Google Play Store. Thank you.